from Vermont Public. This is The Frequency. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, December 20th, and here are today's headlines. Vermont's motel voucher program for people experiencing homelessness has turned away more than 300 eligible households so far this month because it lacks enough rooms to shelter them. That comes as temperatures are forecast to plummet into the single digits this weekend. Frank Knack with the Housing and Homelessness Alliance of Vermont says the situation is deeply concerning.
The notion that we're turning away people who the state recognizes as vulnerable at a time when the weather is as extreme as it is in the Vermont winter, I mean, that can be a death sentence and has been a death sentence for people.
The day before Thanksgiving, two people were found dead in their tent in Wilkett. The cause of their deaths is still under investigation. Another death at an encampment in Berlin was reported a few days later. The Secretary of State's office has launched a more user-friendly online filing system for Vermont businesses. David Hall, Director of Business Systems at the office, says a $5.5 million IT upgrade should make it easier to incorporate new businesses and file annual reports.
I hope that it's more intuitive for you to know that I'm ready to file this initially, or I want to make an amendment here, and you're going to be able to work your way right through that system without too much heartache.
Hall says the new system will also improve cybersecurity protections. The Secretary of State's office processed 125,000 business filings last year, including 15,000 new business formations. Governor Phil Scott and Treasurer Mike Pichek this week announced the launch of the Money Back Program. It's a partnership aimed at proactively returning unclaimed property to Vermonters. The state plans to return nearly $1.3 million in unclaimed property to more than 5,000 residents, using data from the tax department to verify identities and addresses. Unclaimed property includes forgotten assets such as uncashed checks, security deposits, investments, insurance proceeds, and other financial properties. Vermonters eligible for the Money Back Program can expect payouts ranging from $100 to $500. Two North Atlantic right whales have been found entangled in rope and fishing gear 50 miles southeast of Nantucket. Officials say one is likely to die from the injuries. Disentanglement teams are standing by to try and free the whales. With a total population of just about 370, experts say each right whale counts. Scott Landry with Provincetown's Center for Coastal Studies says disentanglement will be difficult.
On top of lack of daylight, we just generally don't have many good weather days at this time of year and don't expect to have any for quite some time.
There are now at least seven entangled North Atlantic right whales swimming off the East Coast. Entanglements and boat collisions are the leading cause of death for the species. Coming up, Erica Heilman speaks with Tan Khun Tongintuk about the journey his parents took to the U.S. in search of a better life. In our recurring series of interviews, What Class Are You? That's after this.
The Frequency is sponsored by the Autosaver Group's year-end sales event going on now at all 15 dealerships in Vermont and Western New Hampshire. Savings on their entire lineup, from trucks, SUVs, and EVs to fuel-efficient cars and family-friendly models. Inventory from all stores at autosavergroup.com. And Gills Point S Tire and Auto Service, offering tire and brake service, oil changes, and state inspections. Online at gillspointstire.com.
Tan Khun Tongintuk's parents each moved alone to the United States in their early 20s to make a new life for themselves. They met in Los Angeles and started a restaurant there. But Tan Khun's father wanted a safer place for his family, so in 2008, they moved to Vermont, where they had to work their way back to owning a business. Their restaurant in Montpelier, Pho Thai Express, has been open since 2015. In this episode of What Class Are You?, reporter Erica Heilman talks with Tan Khun. It begins with why his parents came to the United States.
Their parents wanted them to, you know, pursue like excellence and wanted them to go to America, hey, to build a better future for themselves and for our, like, for their children as well, but just, you know, my brother and I. And that's what they did. Like my dad, everything he does, like, it's all because he wants us to do well. And, you know, that's his goal. But my mom, she made a promise. Like, she promises to her mom that she will work, do everything for us. Like, my dad, he had a goal. But my mom, she made a promise.
When you were growing up in, you know, elementary school, middle school, what were your parents doing?
Like, growing, like, when we moved here, my dad had to work hard because, you know, from going back from nothing to something, we like didn't have that financial power anymore, like as we did in LA. So we had to start all over again. And my dad, you know, we didn't have that much money growing up, which is why he had to work hard, night shifts, because the pay was better than, you know, than average.
What is your memory of who you were in relation to other people in your school life?
Yeah, so talking about that, when I was in like six, when I was in kindergarten, I didn't really thought about that because I thought we were like all the same, you know, like everybody, like it's something you don't really think about when you're like playing Legos with like the other classmates. But, you know, as we like, you know, become more wary of things that goes around, that happens around us. That's when around like first grade, for example, when like my birthday parties, for example, you know, they're all people always having like pizza parties, like renting out places for their, you know, birthdays. And, you know, that is pretty expensive to rent out a place for like the evening and order all these foods and pizzas, right? It costs money. It's not free. I never like really like got mad because I never had one. But whenever we did have money, he would always, you know, he would buy me like clothes, food, toys, like everything so that I could like feel like any other kid in my school at the time.
What did you notice about how the culture of school, how people distinguished each other or characterized each other based on resources, what they had access to?
Yeah, so I started to see that when I entered middle school. I started to see that when people distinguished themselves with their hobbies, you know, like for example, like athletes, they hung out with other athletes. Many of my friends who did sports, they wanted to make varsity for their, as soon as they get to high school, they wanted to make varsity sports. So when I was like in high school, right, I played lacrosse, and lacrosse is a pretty expensive sport with all like the equipment, the helmet, padding, like everything is pretty expensive, like hockey. And I was okay with it because I recently started playing, and I was like thinking about, oh, you know, if I had played young, when I was younger, I could have played for like at a university level, but because I just recently started, you know, it's like obviously not achievable. Could be, but lacrosse is very expensive. Like one club is $1,000, $2,000, and some of these parents, right, like these families, they don't mind paying $1,000 every single year for their kid to play a sport, even if they're not good at it. They just have that money to, you know, be loosely throwing around, while my dad, he had to work pretty hard, you know, to even like get that amount of money. So it wouldn't have been beneficial because my dad, he would have to work twice as hard. And yes, and then I just had that like that. Now I just had that horrible feeling that I was like, I kind of felt envy of other people. I have one friend who's like, his dad is like pretty like wealthy. He's like a businessman. And, you know, to tell him like, oh, my dad owns like a small shop that sells like, you know, Thai food. I wouldn't want to say something for him to think like negatively about. So I was like, should I really tell him that what my parents do for a living? So from not talking to my friends about what my parents do, used to be from like a social thing, but like, oh, they'd be like, what's Thai food? They'll be skeptic about Thai food and the Thai culture. So I kind of kept that hidden. Up until COVID, it transitioned from hiding it socially to like financially hiding about it.
And when did you feel that? Or when did, like, give me an, like,
during COVID, because that's when businesses, you know, start to hurt a lot economically. Our business, like, we were like greatly, greatly hurt. And these people, and like, you know, my friends, you know, they weren't, you know, they were doing fine. I mean, because, you know, they were working jobs that they didn't, that like the parents, they didn't own like a business, for example. So they were just working. They still got money. But my mom and dad, like, they own like the restaurant. COVID like definitely hurt us. Like, we had to take like loans, and you know, it's never a good thing when you hear someone taking out a loan. Like, if I were to talk about getting a loan to my friends, they'd be like, man, this person is not doing financially well. And that's when they wouldn't really drop me because I wasn't financially well, but they'll have like, they'll just think about, you know, isn't Tank a person with a family who's not doing financially well?
What do you think is going to happen to you when you grow up? What do you want?
I want to be like someone like my dad. He's like my role model, my brother's role model. Like I see him as a hardworking person. You know, he's not afraid to get his hands dirty just for us to, you know, just for us to have a good life. And that's something like I look up to, something that what I want to be. When he first moved here with nothing to his name, to something now, like he's like he owns like the restaurant. I want to be something like my dad, like, because he never gave up. My dad never gave up. He could like stop right now with this business just because, you know, he already reached his ideal class. Yeah, so I would keep where I'm at now because, you know, it's like honoring my parents' legacy, right? They got to this class for us and I would want to keep it that way.
This is Erica Heilman with Vermont Public.
And now it's time for our weekly look at news from the world of sports. And the sports report this week is all about the record-breaking University of Vermont men's soccer team and the history made when it ran the table in the playoffs to capture the NCAA Division I national championship. That is something no UVM team in any major team sport other than skiing has ever done. It was also a first for the America East. No soccer team from the conference had ever captured a national title until the Catamounts came along this year. And it began innocently enough, with UVM finishing in a tie with the University of New Hampshire for a share of the America East regular season title. But once the playoffs began, UVM became a juggernaut. First pummeling Iona in a 5-0 win at home, and then winning all the much closer contests that would follow, including heart-pounding victories against Hofstra, San Diego, second-seeded Pittsburgh, the University of Denver, and finally, on Monday night, Marshall University. All those games, save the contest against Pitt, were overtime thrillers. And along the way, UVM earned the nickname the Cardiac Cats for their uncanny ability to score tying goals late in games after falling behind in the second half, then winning in overtime or on penalty kicks, as they did to oust Denver. And with Vermonters all over the state and beyond watching last Monday night, they played comeback kids again, falling behind against Marshall late in the second half in the title game before scoring the equalizer in the 81st minute on a goal by grad student Marcel Papp. At a welcome home celebration held Tuesday at Patrick Gymnasium, Ed Visvari of Shelburne described the feeling he got watching the final unfold.
Oh my gosh, I was watching it with my neighbors and it was just, you know, it was like a repeat of the game on Friday against Denver, where, you know, the other team scores first and you get down to the final minutes and these Cardiac Cats just know how to stay composed. But when it went to overtime, we just felt like they had the momentum. The other team looked a little tired. And when they had that breakaway, you just knew they were going to score.
That breakaway culminated with the history-setting game winner scored by junior forward Maximilian Kissel, who took a long stretch pass in the overtime from teammate Zach Barrett and had one defender to get by before breaking in all alone on the Marshall keeper, dribbling around him before rolling the golden goal into a wide-open net. UVM's star striker and leading goal scorer Yanov Bezzini did not tally in the final. It was the only playoff game in which he did not score at least once, but he said watching that final play unfold, he knew Kissel was going to get the job done.
I knew he was going to be this defender, and I was already standing and starting to celebrate. With exhaustion, I just fell the moment the ball got in.
That exhaustion was evident Tuesday when the team flew back from North Carolina, getting a police escort to take them from the Burlington International Airport to a packed Patrick Gymnasium, where a raspy-voiced head coach Rob Dow addressed the crowd that flooded the lobby, who had to help him remember some of the teams the Catamounts beat to become national champs.
These guys, they traveled over 7,000 miles, right, total to compete for a national championship. Beat the 2-seed, 7-seed, the 13th seed.
Three seed.
Thank you. Thank you.
The enormity of the win was not lost on fan Dave Goyette of Colchester.
It's utterly amazing. I was telling anybody that would listen to me, this is a big deal. You know, major Division I sport, first ever for a university, little old University of Vermont. How about those Catamounts?
Members of the men's basketball team were also on hand at Patrick Gym to cheer their soccer counterparts, and former Senator Patrick Leahy weighed in as well.
I watched the ending of that game. I played it back and watched it again. And I said, wow, none of you will ever forget that. But we Vermonters won't forget it either.
The national champion UVM Catamounts gathered one more time together in the center of the lobby to sing, embrace, and bask in the crowd's gratitude for what they had accomplished. And Coach Dow had one more request for his history-making team.
Cherish the moment. You are national champions.
Thanks for listening to The Frequency today. We had additional reporting from Carly Berlin, Peter Hirschfeld, Nathaniel Wilson, and the New England News Collaborative. Our executive producer is Kevin Trevelyan, and our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Talk to you Monday.
Every episode of Brave Little State begins with a question about Vermont that's been submitted and voted on by listeners like you. What happened to all the restaurant workers? What's the deal with Vermont's fire towers? Why do people like the band Phish? Follow Brave Little State wherever you get podcasts. From Vermont Public, part of the NPR network.